Hello, listeners, and welcome to Sportspiel, the podcast with a far tighter grip on the world of sport than Loris Karius's grip of a football. We're back. It's been a while since we last met up and did a podcast, but joining me as ever to discuss all things sport is Mr. Will Moulton from across the table. How are you?
I was fine until you mentioned that dreadful, terrible,
the Champions awful League. Evening. Yes, as the Liverpool fan on this podcast, how was that to sit through and watch your goalkeeper's finest display?
It was quite amusing. I remember, so it was my birthday as well, which makes it even worse. But I remember when the first goal went in, I just literally screamed, you can't concede a goal like that. How is that possible?
Well, I was watching it in a pub, and the Liverpool fans didn't keep their language quite as measured as that.
I was with my parents, though. So
I just stood there, like, open mouth, like, oh my God, what has just happened?
And then I was open mouthed when Bale scored.
Quite rightly, that was an amazing goal. But there was a Liverpool fan standing behind me who shouted a lot of expletives and was then ejected from
the
pub.
The thing is, even I could tell Karius was going to throw it that way. It was just so obvious. But Benzema was there. It was like, what was he doing?
I don't think he'll ever do that ever again in his life.
I don't think he'll ever do that in anything in a Liverpool shirt again, to be honest.
Also, going back to Bale's goal, probably the best description I had of it was my housemate who said it was a sexual goal.
It was very sexual.
It was a very sexual.
It's highly erotic.
So, it's been, we were clarifying, it seems to be about 7 or 8 weeks since we actually met up to record a podcast. And a lot has happened in that time, mainly our mental health specials, which I think went very well. Down very well, certainly. And we'll put across our thanks again to everyone that was involved in being a part of that month.
It was an epic week, wasn't it? It
was a very big week. But anyway, it's been a while since we did a normal episode. So if you are a new listener, here is a quick rundown of just how the podcast works. The first part of each episode is the discussion section where myself and Will go through some of the big sports stories that caught our eye in the last couple of weeks. On today's show, we will talk about England rugby head coach Eddie Jones's questionable training methods, Zinedine Zidane's bombshell mic drop moment this week, the FA's controversial restructure of the Women's Football League system in England, and finally we will talk about the Stanley Cup final involving two teams no one would have expected to go all the way. The second part of every Sportspiel episode is the feature interview section where we hold a one-on-one interview with a sporting star. This time around, Will had the pleasure of speaking with British sailing athlete Anna Burnett. There's all that and more on episode 23 of Sportspiel. Well then, Eddie Jones, are his training methods a bit too much? For Bruce Craig, the owner of Bath, they certainly are, after he expressed concern at the number of injuries sustained in England training. Craig described the injury toll at his club as totally unacceptable, but the England coach decided to hit back, responding that Premiership clubs have no right to tell him how he should run his side. The row was further exacerbated when Premiership Rugby's chief executive, Mark McCafferty, said, "Training is arguably a much more controllable environment, whether it is a club or country. Are we concerned about injuries happening in training? Absolutely." Ominous, I think. So I ask primarily because I don't know the answer, what is it about Eddie Jones's training sessions and his methods that make them so punishing?
I think his argument is that rugby now is so much more than it used to be in terms of the physicality and everything. And he's talking about the step up between the club level and the international level being great. So he gets these players and he needs to push them hard to get them ready to play test match rugby. I question whether the step up is that great, because you look at the best sides in England and the best sides in France and the best Pro 12 sides, and they're pretty good. I mean, they're not quite the level of the Highlanders and the Crusaders and the Waratahs and all that from the Southern Hemisphere, but they're still at a good level. And the step up, I don't think, is that great. But it's when you hear every time there's a training camp, there are so many injuries that come out from the training. Like, if players are getting injured in matches, you know, fair enough. But the fact is, you're getting so many injuries from training sessions, and half the time it seems that these injuries aren't related to what to rugby. They were doing other things in training sessions that have injured them, which is questionable. Surely you would need to play rugby to get fit for rugby and not be doing judo and athletics. And
well, yeah, part of me wondered, is it him trying to replicate the conditions of a test match? And maybe that's why they're getting injured, but apparently it's not. Well, they're doing other things.
I think it was 2017, you had two separate serious injuries from judo sessions. So you had Sam Jones, a really promising young Wasps player, called up for the first time, goes on a training camp, in a judo session, breaks his leg so badly that he's now had to retire. He's not been able to come back since. And he's, 27 years old. And you have Billy Vunipola, star player. He's had several injuries over the last few years, some of which, you know, have come in games, some of which have, you know, come in training sessions, which happens. But then he also got a serious injury doing judo.
How is judo related to rugby?
I don't
know.
Or am
I just being stupid?
I mean, there's obviously the grappling element, but no, I don't know. It's worrying the amount of players who go away on these England camps and come back injured and can't play for their clubs. And obviously, club comes after country, but you're contracted by your club. You still have a duty to play for them. And if you're not able to play because you're getting injured on international duty, not playing rugby but doing other stuff, then there's clearly something wrong there.
So there's a tour coming up in South Africa, I do believe. How many players have we now lost to injury ahead of that tour?
There's quite a few players out injured at the moment, and it has rested a few as well. So it's a fairly new squad going out to South Africa. But yeah, when you've got the likes of Benno Abano, so he's an upcoming young prop from Bath, he's a really good player, getting injured before a major tour, and you know, he might never get to play for England again, and that's come about as a result of a rugby training camp where we're not entirely sure how the injury came about, but you can be pretty certain it probably wasn't entirely related to rugby. It's crap on the players, to be honest. You know, they've worked so hard for so many years to get to the top, and then to get injured in training before they even get to play the first international match is just a bit rubbish.
So on to, I suppose, the debate topic at hand. And that is, should we actually be dictating what Eddie Jones does in his own training sessions? Because by and large, since he came in, results-wise, it's been a very successful period. So there's obviously something he's doing right. So if he feels the way he's training these players is necessary to get the results that he demands of them, should there be external people and factors interfering with that?
Going back to what you initially said about him getting the results, his methods and his team are now starting to be found out, as proved earlier this year in the Six Nations, when England were pretty average. And yes, they were struggling with injuries, but they just looked unfit. They didn't look sharp or, you know, 100% fitness, and they looked tired. And whether that can be put down to club duty or whether that can be put down to, you know, too much training, it's hard to tell. But the fact is, it's a long season. Obviously, Premiership rugby tried to propose increasing the length of the season, to which the likes of Billy Vunipola turned around and said, no, I'll either play 10 games a season or we'll strike. So clearly the players know that they're being overworked, and now it's a case of trying to find a balance between Test match rugby and international Test match rugby and club rugby. And clearly Eddie Jones, all is not well within that camp at the moment, and his methods are being questioned. So I don't really know.
But then does that raise a question about him as coach rather than a question about his methods?
The funny thing is, the new attacking coach has been brought in this year, who's worked with Eddie Jones two or three times, and he says he's not going to come in and let... He says he's going to come in, but he's not going to let Eddie Jones bully him and tell him what to do. He's going to do things his own way. He says he's not going to be afraid to stand up to Eddie Jones, which gives the impression that the current coaching staff are too afraid of Eddie Jones and won't stand up to him, and he's getting his own way, and there's a suggestion that there is a climate of fear within rugby, and that he sees himself as this all-powerful leader who shouldn't be challenged, and there he's trying to now dictate that on the clubs. But the fact is, these England players aren't centrally contracted. They're contracted by their clubs and England, or just by their clubs. So they should have a say in how the international game is run, in my opinion, because they have a vested interest in their players, and they're professional, and they need their players to be playing at their best, to finish high up the league, to get more money and to survive. But they also need to work alongside Jones, which is the from what I'm understanding, is he's not willing to allow that to happen, which shouldn't be the case.
Obviously didn't know that much about him before he got the England job, other than his exploits with the Japanese team at the last World Cup. But is there now an inflated ego that he has in himself now because of the two back-to-back Six Nations victories that he had early doors, and then suddenly there's this invincible aura of him? Is that now an unhealthy dynamic in the England team right now, is that you have this all-powerful man in charge of the team?
I don't think his ego has been inflated by those two wins. I think he was always like that. But now things are starting to go wrong. We're starting to see a little bit more of it, and more of the defence mechanisms coming out and the blame game and what have you. And to be fair, he's been good on his players. He's not necessarily blaming his players for anything. Whereas some managers, Jose Mourinho, have turned on their players. But he's very defensive with the media, and he's becoming less approachable. Something is, obviously, with the honeymoon period is over, things are not as great as they were. People are starting to turn on him, and people are now starting to question him, and I don't think he likes being questioned and having his training methods questioned, which is why it's quite interesting that this new coach, whose name I've forgotten, which is really bad of me, has been brought in, has worked with him before, and he said he's not afraid to stand up to him, which is a really interesting stance, and that will be a really interesting dynamic to see how those two work together.
But I'm wondering, how many other sports would you get that dynamic where you've got your clubs trying to dictate how the international manager goes about their business, basically? I know other sports people have certainly tried. If you want to look at football, there's always the club versus country row, but by and large the manager of the national team usually goes on and does what he wants to do without that much interference. So to me, it strikes me that there's more of a problem with Eddie Jones as the coach, and maybe all is not well and he won't be in that role for much longer, or as long as we thought anyway.
I think he's there until the World Cup in 2019. I think that's guaranteed.
But wasn't that the plan anyway?
That was the plan anyway. But I think everyone wanted English rugby to be in a better state than it is at the moment, and now question marks are being raised, and now people are already starting to write England off for the World Cup next year, which is worrying. And you just hope that this tour of South Africa, who aren't themselves in a very good position at the moment as well, let's just hope they can go out there, put three good performances in and show that actually English rugby is in a good place. We've got some exciting young talent, and just detract from all this negativity surrounding Jones. You know, whether he is a good coach or not, whether his methods are being questioned, this England side has got a massive World Cup coming up next year, which they need to prove. They need to come back from the debacle that was 2015 and actually put in a good performance. So let's just hope that whatever his faults are, that the players can actually just overcome that, work together as a unit, and put the onus back on them and get people talking about them rather than the off-field distractions.
Final point before we move on. Should Premiership Rugby themselves be getting involved in this?
I think they were right to run that audit alongside the RFU.
And ask the question.
I think that it needed to be answered, because it seems like every time there is an England camp, someone gets a stupid injury or a really serious injury. And that's worrying, because obviously rugby is so much more physical, but you'd expect more of the injuries to be coming from the games in that case and not the training. So clearly there is some sort of an issue with the training methods. I think they're right to ask the question. Is it the right time? I don't know. It's difficult to tell when would be the perfect time to announce something like this, but I think they're right to ask the question. Should they get involved? I think they're right to have a voice and have an opinion. Whether there's actually anything they can do, though, I don't really know, because ultimately it's Eddie Jones' side. He's in charge. He can do what he wants.
He has the ultimate.
He has the ultimate say-so.
So, moving on to topic number two, and that's Zizou. What did you do? I apologise for my rhyming. So on May 31st, that was 5 days after winning a third successive Champions League trophy, a match that we have already talked about, Zinedine Zidane went and announced in a shock press conference that he was off and he had quit his role as manager of Real Madrid. The former French international told the media that the club needed a different voice, that everything changes, and that's why he took the decision. After 2.5 years in charge, he leaves with 9 trophies and he won 104 of his 149 games in charge. So, when you heard the news, surprised, shocked, or to be expected?
I think because I'd heard a few hours before that he called a snap press conference. I think we all knew what was coming. So when he actually said I've resigned, I was a bit non-perplexed. Yeah, non-perplexed because I guessed it was coming. And there had been talk before the Champions League final that he was going to leave anyway if they didn't win. I guess it was a little bit surprising. But then again, Real Madrid is probably the most tiring job there is in management. Yes. And if you're going to go at the top. And apart from one headbutt aside, he was always quite a classy individual. And he's done it in a good way. And he's left the club on a high note, something to build on. So
The greatest headbutt of all time.
It was quite a good headbutt.
I suppose, in a lot of ways, the writing was on the wall when Ronaldo and Gareth Bale both made comments about their future immediately after the final whistle went in that game. Kind of signalled something's not all is quite well here. And you mention Real Madrid as a club and as a team. That squad has a lot of egos and a lot of people to manage in there. And it's been said by a few people that it's a team of individuals. It's not a team, which is why plenty of people, myself included, struggle to name it as a great side. But considering what they've done by winning 3 successive Champions League trophies, you kind of have to put them in the great side mantle, no matter how much it pains you, because they are a team of individuals. And I think that's effectively what has pushed them over the edge and why no manager ever lasts that long there.
I think the difference this year compared to when they won the first of those 3 2 years ago was they looked fallible this year. They looked beatable. 2 years ago, they looked pretty invincible, both in the league and in the Champions League. Whereas this time round, you know, a lot of Liverpool fans went into the final thinking they could pull off a result. And if it hadn't been for the keeper, who knows? Because Liverpool weren't that far behind Madrid. You know, Madrid did enjoy the majority of possession and some of the better chances. But Liverpool, you know, still scored that goal. And of the 3 goals that went in, you can't really blame anyone but the keeper. 2 howlers and 1 worldie. You know, you can't turn around and say Madrid deserved to win the game. So you can say that, you know, this is a good Madrid side that he's leaving, but they're not as good as they were 2 years ago when he first took over. So that is why I would also struggle to label them necessarily a great side.
I think by him leaving on his own terms as well, the ball is now very much in his court. As if he's going out with his reputation still on the high. He's just won a Champions League again. So he's taking a year break. Whether he'll come back or not, we don't know. And what job he'll go to, we'll have a better idea in 12 months' time. But he's left himself in the best possible position as well.
But he's walked into a club that he knows with a bunch of players that he knows because he worked there as an ambassador before. So that job was almost tailor-made for him to be successful. Wherever he goes next, I don't think he can possibly expect to have the same level of success.
I do think, though, what also helps him is that wherever he goes, he's guaranteed respect because of what he's done in his career as a player and now as a manager.
And who he is as a person as well. He always comes across very well.
Yeah, like you said, one headbutt aside, he's been a very classy individual over the years.
But could you imagine him going to a mid-table Premier League side, someone like Bournemouth or West Ham, and being successful?
In all honesty, I think if you were a betting man right now, you'd probably say Juventus. Because of the connection he has with that team. And that job may become available very soon.
It may do. I mean, Allegri could be on his way to Real Madrid.
Like, yes.
Or Chelsea.
This is where we come onto the who's next portion of this little chat.
Well, we all know who he wants it to be.
who do we want it to
Arsene
be?
Arsene Wenger.
That's still going to
be the greatest thing that would ever
weird. So, yeah, he's understandably one of the favourites looking for a job right now for the first time in 22 years. Pochettino as well has also been touted as perhaps taking that step up from Tottenham to Real Madrid.
Yeah, I mean, Pochettino has just signed a new multi-year contract, but
what's a contract mean?
There isn't a clause in it allowing him to leave for Madrid, but he didn't help with his comments made on the day of Zidane's resignation. It was a very wishy-washy answer he gave to the question, are you going to Real Madrid? It wasn't a yes or a no, it was somewhere in between. which has got a few Tottenham fans worried, I think.
Yes, and considering his connection with Spain as a player and also his connection with Espanyol, a lot of people were thinking if his managerial trajectory is going to continue as expected, Barcelona or Real Madrid, he's going to be going for Real Madrid if given the choice of the two.
But Pochettino doesn't have a record of winning things. I mean, I know Zidane didn't, but Pochettino has done great things with Southampton and Spurs, especially in bringing through the youngsters, playing exciting football, but he's never won anything. Is that going to be something that you think Real Madrid will take into consideration?
I think so, but we'll see. Another name mentioned, Jurgen Klopp.
He's not going anywhere.
Liverpool. That has, some rumours have been floating around recently. Also, Maurizio Sarri, formerly of Napoli, but very heavily linked with Chelsea.
Absolute nutter.
Proper nutter. But actually quite an interesting person too. So obviously if he goes to Chelsea, there is another manager who will be available, and that is the current Chelsea boss, Antonio Conte, whose days look very numbered.
He's not going to be there for much longer, is he, Conte, at Chelsea? So
the writing is on the wall there.
There's also Guti, the former Real Madrid player, has been linked. He's also heavily linked with a job in Scotland at the moment as well, but he's been the youth coach at Real Madrid for a couple of years, so he knows the system, he knows the players.
That's how
Zidane ended up. And he's another club legend, so
getting the job as well. But yes, we'll wait and see, and I'm sure it won't be all that long until we find out who is actually going to replace Zidane as boss.
They're normally quite quick movers at Real, aren't they?
Oh, so. Yeah. But sticking with football, and we'll move on to topic number three, and it's a controversial one, to say the least, and it's one that we knew was coming earlier in the year because the FA announced that it wanted to make WSL 1 a fully professional league. But that meant there would be winners and losers as clubs scrambled to get cash together and get their applications in to be a part of that fully professional league. Sure enough, when the announcement was made on May 28th, that's Monday, about which clubs were going to go where in the new restructured women's football pyramid, it was clear to see who lost out the most. But firstly, before we talk about the losers, let's talk about the winners. And as the resident West Ham fan on this podcast, it's very clear to see who gained the most out of this. And that is West Ham United, ladies, who have gone straight into the top flight, the WSL, from the third tier.
Mid-table in the third
mid-table
tier.
Of the third tier.
I mean,
tier.
Admittedly, that was quite an improvement from a couple of years before, but...
Yes. So if we look at the money invested in West Ham recently, because the club was taken in-house a year and a half ago. And I remember watching Stacey Little, of course, who was episode 3 guest
Sports
on this
Bill
podcast.
Legend.
Long time ago now that she was on. I remember her in that midfield playing for West Ham at Averley Football Club. And you've clearly never been to Averley in your life. I can tell you the stadium is not the greatest in the world. Every shot at goal somehow went over the fence, which is about 3 feet high. So most of the coaches, one of whom was Julian Dix, because that's when he was head coach of the team, they've been spending most of the time chasing the balls down rather than actually coaching from the bench. So that sums up how much has changed in that time. It was Stephen Hunt, who was the chairman, who kind of kicked up a fuss in the press about the lack of funding the ladies' team were receiving. And then a matter of weeks later, suddenly West Ham had taken over the ladies' team. And it was Jack Sullivan, the son of David Sullivan, owner of West Ham, who I think is still like 16, 17 years old, and he was made the managing director of the team. And considering how young he is, I think there's a fair bit of business acumen on his part. And they said right from the off, the quest was to get the team into the top flight. And within a year and a bit, they managed to do it by pulling together the right funds. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens.
Well, there's an example of the success of being affiliated within
with their Premier League
a
team.
Successful men's team. On the flip side is losers. My team, Sunderland Ladies, who have found out that being affiliated quite closely with the men's team isn't always the best thing, as they have lost their, not just their top flight status, but their sort of professional status, because they will be dropping from the WSL 1, where they finished 7th this season, despite being part-time. They put up a fantastic fight, and they're very, very talented bunch of players there.
Think of the players that have come through that team
as
well.
Yeah, I know.
The amount of
Beth
England Mies, players.
Jill Scott, Lucy Bronze.
You say Lucy Bronze. I don't know if you saw her tweet when it was announced that Sunderland were going to drop into the third tier. I pulled it up now because it sends a very important message, actually. So she tweeted out, "So when I was 11 years old, I was told by the FA I couldn't play in my local team anymore because I was a girl. So at 12, my parents ended up driving me 60 miles to and from Sunderland Ladies, all because I wanted to play football. I understand that dream has just got a lot harder for the girls and parents in the Northeast, but don't stop. You are just going to have to work a little harder than everyone else to get where you want to be. But trust me, 15 years later, when you have a Champions League medal around your neck, you'll look back and thank them for giving you the fight you needed to succeed." Rather aptly, the fight aspect is kind of what's happened next, because yesterday, as we record, that's Friday, Sunderland have appealed that decision.
And rightly so. I think they've been operating part-time for a year and a half, if not more, and they've kept their top-flight status. You know, they've given teams like Arsenal and Liverpool some decent games. All right, they've been thrashed on a couple of occasions, but they've also put up some good fights. And I quite wrongly assumed they'd just be put into WSL 2, but clearly there is a worry there with the men having dropped down to the third tier and struggling for funds in some areas, that there's a worry from the FA that Sunderland ladies may not be able to sustain themselves or something, which is why they've dropped them out entirely. But I think that was a wrong decision. I mean, I'm biased because I was lucky enough to do some work with them. Fantastic club, great bunch of people. And I also support them. But I think that, you know, if they'd done a Yeovil and got thrashed and become bottom of the WSL 1 and not won any games and were part-time, I can understand it. But the fact is they put up a good performance all season.
The restructure is controversial because I think we can all agree with the end goal in that it's great to have a fully professional league. But it's the way in which it's come about. It's very, very quick. And it's all about money and who's got the financial backing right now, rather than it being earned on actual training,
well, you've
academy
got
investment.
Manchester United, who haven't had a women's team for however many years, all of a sudden they're in the second tier, potentially with Casey Stoney as manager, just from nothing. I mean, I think it's fantastic they're getting a club, and kudos to everyone who's brought that back, including Phil Neville. But it's just frustrating when you see teams like West Ham, who finished seventh in the third tier, and you've got a team, C&K Basildon, who Stacey Little used to play for and now coaches, they come second, but because they haven't got the money, they're not being promoted.
Exactly.
West Ham come seventh and they go straight up. It's frustrating, but women's game is still very much in the infancy, and this isn't the last version of the Super
yes.
League that we'll see.
I think
it will change again, but hopefully it will just keep growing. We'll get more professional teams, more women playing football. That will make our England side better, and that will make football, women's football overall better. So I think this is the beginning of something good. It's just frustrating that it's impacted my team.
Yes. No, from my point of view, happy days. For full disclosure, the WSL, which is the top tier now, is made up of 11 teams. That's Arsenal, Birmingham, Brighton, Bristol City, Chelsea, Everton, Liverpool, Manchester City, Reading, Yeovil, and newcomers, West Ham. The second tier is now called the FA Women's Championship and is made up of 12 teams. Aston Villa, Doncaster Rovers Bells, Durham, Whoops. London Bees, Millwall Lionesses, who are having their own financial problems right now, Sheffield FC, Tottenham, Charlton, Leicester City, Lewis, Sheffield United and Manchester United to make up the top two tiers. Interesting to see how this actually plays out next season. Oh, we were also talking, I should mention this, well, we discussed it off air, promotion and relegation. We don't think it exists.
It's very hard to find, isn't it?
Because if it did, that would totally defeat the point of a fully professional top tier. So we predict this is going to be very much an American-style thing, where as each team that's not in the top flight manages to get their finances in order to fully fund a professional team, then the applications will come in and it will slowly expand.
And you've got some teams in the WSL, well, not the WSL, so the Championship.
The Women's
now,
Championship.
Who, you know, in a few years, we reckon will be able to become full-time. You've got Tottenham and you've got Leicester and Charlton. You know, in a few years' time, they'll be able to come top flight and full-time, sorry, and go up into the top flight. So it's all very promising. And I think women's football is in a healthier state than it was a few years ago. It's just
how long until another restructure?
Yeah. It's just that worry about, you know, what if it doesn't go right? Or
because it's confusing enough as it is, to be honest.
And the lack of promotion and relegation is something that's going to confuse English fans, because mm-hmm. that's what we're so used to.
Exactly. But it's ingrained in us.
Hopefully, you know, the BBC and BT and Sky hopefully will get on board to do some fantastic coverage and just create the exposure, get more girls wanting to play football, and hopefully it will just be an upward trajectory.
That's,
hopefully.
Yes, that's what we want to see.
With my positive hat on.
So, moving on to the fourth and final topic on this discussion section before we dive into some feature interview action. And that is the 2018 Stanley Cup Final, which is the conclusion of the NHL playoffs for those who aren't in the know. And this year it's being fought between the Washington Capitals and the Vegas Golden Knights. As we record, because we're recording on Saturday, there have been two games played because it's a best of seven game series. It began on Monday, May 28th, and Vegas won the first one 6-4, and then Washington won the second one 3-2, so it's one apiece. Game three is tonight, Saturday night, so by the time this goes out, someone will have a 2-1 lead. Who knows who at this point? Now, other than being the NHL fanboy on the pod, if anyone predicted at the start of this season that these two teams would be the finalists, they would have been put into a mental institution. This is
harsh,
harsh, but slightly true. Neither team has ever won the cup. Washington, they've had a Stanley Cup winning caliber team for a while, but for long time listeners of this podcast, they will remember when I slagged them off as chief chokers, because they kept bottling it when they got the opportunity to actually make it to the final. But the real story is Vegas, essentially, which is why I think my heart wants it to happen so much, because we all remember Leicester and what they did by winning the Premier League three years ago now. This is a Leicester-esque story. So if Vegas win the Stanley Cup, they will be doing a Leicester.
Now, didn't you explain this to me before off-air?
Mm-hmm.
Comparing them to Leicester, Leicester was a bunch of talented individuals that, you know, people knew were good. Whereas from what you explained to me, these players that are playing for Las Vegas...
Yes.
Have not been plucked off the scrap heap, but I've been
pretty close to that.
Is that right?
Yes. So for those not in the know, Vegas, this time last year, Vegas didn't exist. They didn't have a team. They are an expansion team. This is their first ever season. They're the 31st team in the NHL. So when the team arrives, rather than being a relocated team, there's what is called an expansion draft at the start of the year, because this team obviously has no players. An expansion draft is basically Vegas gets to pick one player from every other team in the NHL. So it's all 30 other teams. However, every NHL team gets to protect, I think it's 8 or 9 players, different ways of doing it. So all the players that are available to Vegas are players that the other teams don't mind losing. They're not the stars. They're not the young up-and-coming kids that will be stars in the future. They're the rejects and the misfits, which have been words bandied around quite a lot. This also wasn't the plan for the management team at Vegas. The idea was to draft a lot of players that they could then trade in that expansion draft and get some younger up-and-coming prospects, and then maybe have a go at winning something in about 6 years' time, when all of these young kids were at the right age and ready to actually have an impact. So the fact that they have managed to go through the season breaking all manner of records, they've broken records in terms of all-time wins from an expansion team, they won the division in their first season, never been done before, went and won their conference in the playoffs, never been done before, and are now in the Stanley Cup final, never been done before. It's also, as well as the whole it being a misfit thing, there's the narrative about the Vegas shooting, which we all remember back in October, when, can't remember the guy's name, but there was the concert, the music festival, and he basically fired on all the concert goers from a hotel room. And that happened 9 days before Vegas' first ever home game. And what was going to be a big celebration of sport coming to Vegas ended up becoming much more of a memorial service. And the alternate captain, Derek Engeland, who's kind of the only Las Vegas-based player in that team, ended up having to address the crowd. and giving tributes to the play, to the those that lost their lives and to the first responders. And I don't know if we can attribute it to that, but ever since that happened, the fandom and the momentum has just continued throughout the entire season, and this team just don't know when to quit.
Is it as simple as that, though? It's just the momentum carrying them forward, or is it something they do in their play which is just, you know, that teams can't cope with?
A lot of these players, the misfits, have had career seasons. I've mentioned someone like William Carlson, for example, who has scored, I think, 30-plus goals in the regular season, and that's about three times as more than he's ever managed before in a previous career. So it's something about that dynamic that just seems to work. They're very fast, we'll give them that, but looking at this team on paper, they shouldn't be where they are. It's, at the start of the season, they were predicted to be last, second last in their division. So a lot of credit has to go to the coach, Gerard Gallant, who is probably the favourite to win Coach of the Year, understandably, for how he's managed to put this team together. Actually, while I'm on that subject, one player does deserve a lot of credit, and that's Marc-Andre Fleury, a name who would be quite familiar because he was the Pittsburgh Penguins goaltender for a number of years before he was ousted as first choice by young, up-and-coming Matt Murray. Because Pittsburgh had two goaltenders who are pretty much as good as each other, you can only protect one in the expansion draft. Vegas went and got Fleury, and he has been arguably better than he's ever been before, and is a large reason as to why they're in the Stanley Cup final now, because of his phenomenal game-winning saves and performances. And also, I've mentioned that Vegas shooting again, and it's just continued throughout the year. On the last, it was lovely to see on their last home game of the season, they retired the 58 jersey in honour of the 58 people that died, and there's now a banner hanging in the rafters of the arena with all the names of the victims. So that whole hashtag Vegas Strong message has continued. It's just given people something to latch onto, I think.
It's an incredible story. In some way, it reminds me of Braun, Formula One team 2009.
There you go, yes.
You know, all the mess that was Honda, didn't know sort of what was going on. One coach, in this case, or one team owner, came in and made this incredible team that surpassed everything. And it's almost feels like this has come from a Hollywood script rather than real life.
It's very Hollywood script-esque. And that Braun thing is actually quite a good similarity. You just get a bunch of people, find a goal that everyone can latch onto, and they just go.
Yeah.
People have been betting against this team time and time again. Same as Leicester. It's got to drop off at some point. They have to reach their level at some point, and it just hasn't happened.
Hopefully, if it happens, it's after they win the Stanley Cup.
That would be nice.
That would be an incredible story.
If they do actually win it, it would be an incredible story. But brief mention for Washington as well, because after slagging them off for God knows how long for not actually doing it in the playoffs, they came up against Pittsburgh, who've won the previous two Stanley Cups, and that was always their Achilles heel. Every time they came up against Pittsburgh in the playoffs, they'd always lose. They'd always bottle it. And this year they didn't. It took them seven games to do it, and they literally all burst out crying when they managed to do it because they got the monkey off the back. But as soon as the monkey got off the back, that's it. Off they went into the Stanley Cup final. And it would be great for someone like Alex Ovechkin, who's the captain, who is one of the all-time greats of the NHL in history. It would be nice for him to actually finally get that cup that he doesn't have. So whoever wins, it's a great story.
I still want the Vegas team to win.
That's where I'm at the moment. If I had to pick, if Vegas win it, that is one of the most incredible sports stories of all time. So it's a team without fear. And if they do win it, expect that movie to be made very soon.
I look forward to it.
And with that, that concludes our discussion section on this episode. But stick around, because after the break, we have our feature interview segment, and to introduce his guest, Anna Burnett, Will Walton.
Yes, indeed. And one of the upcoming stars of British sailing is Anna Burnett. So she explains to us the type of sailing she does, the category she races in. It's a mixed category. So she explains all about that, how she got into sailing in the first place. You know, how difficult it can be sometimes to be out by yourself on the water. And her hopes going forward. She's a very strong candidate for Tokyo 2020. Only one British boat will go, and currently, you know, she's in a real dogfight with the other British crew, so that's going to be a really interesting narrative to play out. And it's a really good, fun interview. Anna's a lovely person, so yeah, stick around for that. Hello, listeners, and welcome to another Sports Spiel feature interview, where I'm delighted to say that today we are joined by GB sailor Anna Burnett. Welcome to the show, Anna, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, go to the very beginning, and reading up on you, you say your parents got you into sailing, but it's not a conventional sport in terms of, you know, like hockey or tennis or football, where you can go and sort of watch your parents on the sideline. So, just wondering sort of how exactly your parents did get you involved. Was it literally taking you on the boat, or what was it?
Kind of a bit of that. And so we live, I grew up in Helensburgh, up on the west coast of Scotland, right next to the sea. So kind of we're always around the water. And my whole family have always been into sailing. My dad's a really keen sailor. So I think he, when we were really young, he bought us a little dinghy and took us out sailing in that, and then we joined in with local training, just like sailing with my friends, really. And that's kind of how we got into it.
So how old were you when you sort of first went on a boat then?
I probably went on a boat with my parents when I was 5 or 6, and then started sailing and going on to a club when I was maybe 7 or 8, I think.
And you say that it was in the family. Was it an immediate sort of enjoyment for you going on the boat, or were there sort of a few moments where you think you might not have liked it?
I think I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed being with my friends and that side of the club, you know, the community sense of it. But there was also a lot of times, especially as I got older and did a little bit more, that I was like, oh, I don't really like being cold and wet the whole time, and it's a bit scary. I guess there was quite a lot of that, and I think my dad was quite good at just pushing me out and making me go and do it. And I'm really glad
that. And you started sailing, as you say, as a young age. Were there any other sports you would do when you were younger, or was it always just getting out in a boat and sailing?
Kind of every sport. I'm really into kind of anything. Still do other sports, but I did a lot of swimming and tennis. I was really into my tennis when I was little, and I basically did as much tennis as I did sailing up until, I don't know, 11 probably, and then had to kind of sideline the tennis a bit for sailing.
Was that quite an easy decision to make for the sailing, or was it quite a tough one?
It's quite tough at that age. I remember kind of vividly thinking that I didn't really like the cold, wet winters in Scotland with sailing. I preferred tennis in that sense because it was dry, but I also thought I was already that. At national level for sailing, and I was in kind of county level at tennis. So I thought if I was going to make it as an athlete, then sailing was the way to go.
And clearly, you know, you made the right choice there. And jumping forward quite a bit. Sorry, and jumping forward quite a bit. You now compete in, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, but something called the NACRA 17 category. And for most people, that doesn't mean a lot. So I was just wondering if you could sort of explain in quite simple terms what that is.
Yeah, so the NACRA 17 is it's a catamaran, a multi-hull, and it's the Olympic class mixed multi-hull. So I sail with a boy, and it's the boats are now foiling, which is a new development for this Olympic cycle. So there was a NACRA 17 at the Rio Olympics, but now they've developed so they are on hydrofoils, which means the boats lift out the water, so the speeds are higher. And it's the only class in the Olympics which is mixed, which is quite cool.
And there are so many sort of different funny names in sailing, and the name sort of NACRA doesn't really immediately spring to the description you gave of it. What are all the names, like the fin and the laser, sort of what are they based on?
I think to do with the designer. So the NACRA is NACRA, the company, designed and produced the boats. That's why that's that. And I think pretty similar to the rest of them. Or some of them, like the 470, is called the 470 because it's because of the length.
Okay, so that...
Usually kind of something to do with the designer or the length of the boat, if it's a number.
Okay, and you sort of made the switch to the NACRA 17 category, to the mixed team event, sort of a couple of years back. What sort of made that decision for you?
But at the time, I'd sailed a couple of the other Olympic classes, and I'd been learning a lot, but I didn't have a teammate. And John, who I sailed now, he asked me if I wanted to sail the in the next 17 with him and campaign for the Tokyo Olympics. So it hadn't really been on my radar before. But the opportunity to team up with John was really appealing because he's an amazing sailor and he's achieved a lot already. So yeah, we get on really well, and it's kind of more for us about setting up a really good team. Didn't matter so much what the boat was, but it's so quite lucky to sail in the next 17 because it's a fun boat. It's the fastest one in the Olympics, so can't go too wrong with that.
Definitely not on. Again, for those of us who don't really watch sailing, can you sort of explain sort of the different roles you and John have and how you interact on the boat?
So John steers the boat, and we're both trapeze, so we both wear harnesses that we hook onto a wire and hang off the side of the boat, which is maybe a bit difficult to try and picture if you haven't seen it before. but then John's steering, so he's holding on to it's called a tiller extension. It's kind of a rod that's basically attached to the rudders, which steer the boat. And then, and I'm holding on to the main sheet, so I'm in control of the mainsail and trimming that, and then the spinnaker downwind.
And since you've become a partnership, you've had a number of really solid results. Coming, I think it was sixth at last year's World Championships. And has it gone sort of as expected, or even better than expected?
I think at first it was going kind of as well as good as we possibly could hope. At least we were straight up into the mix. And since then we've always been there or thereabouts. And there's just, we're not too far off the medals, but we haven't actually finished outside the top six, I don't think, at an international event yet. But we've won a few medals, but we're last couple of events we've been sixth and fifth, so we're in the mix, but. I think, we both know that there's just a bit of work to be done to get up into the medal.
You speak about your consistent finishes there, and obviously we're only 2 years into the four-year Olympic cycle, so even though maybe more recent results haven't quite gone your way, the fact that you're so consistent must be quite a positive thing in pushing forward to Tokyo.
Yeah, I think for sure. I think one of the strengths of our team is that we can get through a regatta and kind of pull ourselves back into the mix with some of the top guys. I think reflecting on some of our recent results, we know that there's a few areas of our sailing that we need to improve on, and we feel we've got the time to improve on those make small changes that I think will impact a lot on the results at the end of the event.
And I imagine with teamwork being so crucial, you have to develop quite a strong relationship with your teammates. So with John, do you spend therefore quite a lot of time together away from the boat doing sort of things and getting to know each other a bit better?
To be honest, we spend our whole time doing stuff for the campaign, so it's quite full on, especially over the winter with the training period, we're pretty flat out, so we do spend a lot of time together away training and competing, I'm sure if we had more time to be doing other things, then we'd probably be going kite surfing and stuff. Because we do get on really well, but honestly, yes, spend our whole time sailing, so there's not much time for other stuff.
Fair enough. And one of your biggest rivals is actually another British pair and current world champions, Ben Saxton and Nicola Boniface. And what's the sort of level of interaction between the two of you like? Do you actually spend much time together, or is it because you're sailing all the time quite limited?
No, we do spend a lot of time together, and we do train together. The whole British team, there's four NAC 17 teams, of which Ben is one of them. So over the winter we train together in Portugal, and we get on well with all of the British NAC guys, and up until it comes down to the actual trials to select you for the Olympics. So it's all friendly, and we'll work together.
You say it's all friendly, but I imagine then when you're out on the water, though, is it you have to just treat them as another competitor and almost forget that you're there, sort of your friends and your teammates?
Yeah, once you get on the race course, everyone's a rival, but we're all pretty amicable, and you try not to screw over your compatriots until it comes down to the trials, I guess.
What is it like actually taking part in a sailing race? Because many of us have seen,
athletics races in stadiums packed full of people and football games, you know, packed full of people cheering them on. But sailing, is it quite a bit different? Is there, can you ever, you know, hear a crowd, for example?
I've never competed in a race where you've been able to hear the crowd, but I know when you get to the Olympics and in venues, actually that's a lie. In Santander, we were doing the time I've raced in Spain, where we raced very close to the shore for some of the races, and there was a crowd there. And that's pretty cool because you can't hear them, but generally we're racing, like, I don't know, half a mile out to sea, and there's the only people there watching are the if people are out in spectator boats or coach boats. So yeah, there's not much interaction with spectators, and it's all sailing's very it's a real mind game. It's very tactical. So actually, you know, once you're in a race, you're very focused within your team, talking to each other and looking around. So I think even if there was a crowd, it'd be quite hard to take that in.
And is there much chatter? So I know you say you're focused, but can you, you know, if you were to be out there as a spectator, would you be able to hear quite a lot of different chatter and going on between different teammates and different teams?
I think it's quite hard, you know, just with the nature of the environment of being out in the water, it's quite hard to hear unless people are shouting. But now the coverage is quite good, so when we go do all the World Cup events, they live stream the racing, and so often we have people coming to watch. And these lifts on the shore, they'll have big screens, and when they have that, they sometimes put cameras on the boats, and which pick up the sailing, the conversations that are going on in the boats. So I think that's making it a lot more interactive with spectators.
And you mentioned there earlier on about how tactical and how much of a mind game sailing is, but it must also, you know, with some of the conditions you face, it must also be quite physically demanding as well. Do you have to do a lot of work to actually be physically fit to sail competitively?
Yeah, so the next 17 is a really physical boat, especially in the role I'm doing with the sheet loads for trimming the sails are really high. So it's quite, I do quite a lot of strength-based training when I'm not in the boat. So yeah, I spend a lot of time in the gym, working on strength, and then on the aerobic side of things. Luckily for me, I think I really enjoy doing other sports and cycling and stuff, so I think that's pretty helpful for the aerobic stuff. But it's quite interval based. Our races are kind of 30 minutes long generally, so and within that you'll have the high peaks of high workload. But then, so it's, yeah, a lot of it's muscular endurance and quite physically demanding.
And do you do a lot of sort of mental training away from the boat as well? Do you spend a lot of time with psychologists and stuff like that?
We always have the option to do that within the Brazilian team. We're well supported in those areas. And we, so far, we haven't actually done a lot with the psychologists, but I'm sure there's always gains to be made, especially with decision-making stuff, because decision-making and sailing is massive. And yes, so I'm sure, you know, we will take the time at some stage to talk to people that, you know, are well informed in decision making areas and see if we can make any gains on that.
Sailing, sort of on those lines, sailing is a sport that's seemingly growing and changing all the time in terms of, you know, the different approaches and even the different vessels. Is it quite easy to actually keep up with sort of the changes that are happening and adapt to this different situations?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of change for us with the boat going hydrofoiling this cycle. And so just the advancements, everything's become very high performance and, you know, the speeds are changing and it's become faster and more physical. But that's all, I don't know, I find it exciting. I think it's not... I guess it is hard to keep up with it, but you've just got to be you've got to be willing to put the work in, because if you're not, then other people are going to, and they're going to beat you.
And there's not just changes in terms of the sport, but and also how the sport is perceived, and specifically in this country we've had the likes of Sir Ben Ainslie, Giles Scott, Hannah Mills and Saskia Clark over the last few years. Have you noticed sort of quite a big difference in how people perceive sailing within Britain and maybe even across the world?
Yeah, I think those guys that you've mentioned, Ben Ainslie, and they've got a huge amount for our sport in raising the profile. And I do think, yeah, more people know about Olympic sailing and about the America's Cup, which is also a massive event in sailing. And yeah, Ben Ainslie's done played a huge part in that and raising the profile. So it's really great to see the sport growing and to see, I think, the membership's always growing with the RA, which is the governing body. So I think, yeah, it's great to see more people getting into sailing, and hopefully the more that we can improve the way it's displayed and for spectators, and the way improving TV and cameras and all of that sort of kind of that side of things is really helping. So hopefully that will just continue to improve.
And Great Britain themselves are currently the most successful Olympic sailing nation ever. Does that give sort of an added pressure to you when you race, or is that something you take on as a privilege to be a part of the most successful Olympic sailing nation ever?
I think it's a real privilege, but it's not something that you can ever take for granted, because other countries are necessarily the top sailing nation the whole of the time. When everyone's fighting really hard to win medals, so it's hotly contested across all of the Olympic classes, and the British team's got a lot on their hands to live up to those really successful sailors in Ian Percy, Andrew Simpson, and Ben Ainslie, and those kind of guys who've won gold medals in the past. We've got a lot to live up to, and we just need to keep working really hard, because other countries are always snapping at our heels.
And for you, going forward over the next 2 years, what's the sort of plan, and what do you feel like you have to do in order to make the Tokyo squad selection?
I think just remaining a solid team and always making sure we're reviewing each event, and just we've got a solid plan that we've been following, we will follow up to the Olympics, and it's just constantly making sure we're reviewing and we're on track with that, and pushing really hard in all areas of the campaign. There's a massive amount to do, and it's a big mountain to climb, and especially getting the qualification spot in Britain, which is really hotly contested with slots for next 17 to three teams to beat if we're going to be the team to go. So I think for us it's just about following our plan and sticking to what we think is the right thing to do, and if we can come through with that, then hopefully we'll be in good shape.
And finally, you'll be when you go to Tokyo, you'll be sailing in one of the most beautiful countries in the world, a lot of people say, but you must see some beautiful places where you travel. Are there any sort of favourites you particularly enjoy racing at?
Yeah, we're very lucky in that respect. There's a lot of really cool places that we get to go. Not that we see a lot other than just the water and the sailing club, but Lake Garda in Italy, that's one of my favourites, and I think probably a favourite of a lot of sailors, because it's just really beautiful and really good sailing. And I think next year we've got our World Championships in New Zealand, 2019. And I've sailed there before, and that's a really cool place to go, so I'm really looking forward to going back there.
And we're certainly very much looking forward to seeing your progress and how you race. Anna, thank you so much for coming on. We wish you the best of luck for the future, and we really hope to see you at Tokyo in 2 years' time.
Thanks very much. I'll do my best.
Well, we hoped everyone enjoyed that interview with Anna Burnett. But before we go, let's point everyone in the direction, as usual, to our social media pages. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and we're on Instagram. All of our handles are SportSpielPod, so come and follow, like, all of that stuff, and see what we're up to during the week when we're not actually recording. And as always, you can send us feedback. Our email address is sportspielpod@gmail.com. So tell us what you like, tell us what you don't like, or just say hi, what's going on, we'll answer, and we'll say hi back. Anything else we need to address before we pop off?
No, just a thank you to Marvin at The Sweat Experience for setting that interview up with Anna. Much appreciated. And thank you to Anna for coming on.
Of course.
And thank you to you for helping me through this.
We'll say no more. Anyway, with that, we will be back as normal in 2 weeks with episode 24. Details, as ever, will be plonked onto social media in the run-up, so you know what's coming. But until then, have fun, everyone, and enjoy your next fortnight. Bye-bye.